Blog Talk Radio.
Amazing.
Art.
New.
Wine.
Music.
Spirit.
Incredible.
Love.
Experience.
Music.
Thank you for tuning into Artsy's Diner Radio, the voice of artsysdiner.com. And now, our feature presentation.
Thank you for joining Artsy's Diner Radio Network, the voice of artsysdiner.com. Artsy's Diner Radio Network brings you musicians, artists, authors, thinkers, dreamers from all over the world. Artsy's Diner is that special little virtual diner now going on its sixth year. Like a fine wine, it is getting better with time. So pull up a chair, grab that favorite beverage, sit back and enjoy the show. Artsy's Diner, changing the world, one song at a time, one heart at a time. And now, the host of our show.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much for joining us. This is a very exciting show for me. I have been looking forward to this particular conversation for, I think a couple months now, so it's very exciting. I am Mary E. LaLuna. Many of you know me as one of the hosts of Artsy's Diner Radio, as well as the founder of artsysdiner.com. And tonight actually is an exciting show for me because tonight marks the 100,000 listener point. Yeah, since the 18th of February, we have now gone past 100,000 listeners. So that's very exciting for us. And I just want to give a major shout out to Blog Talk Radio for being so kind and featuring so many of our shows. Thank you. You make it a privilege and an honor to bring amazing people to the listening audience. I also want to give special thanks to Steve Champagne. If it wasn't for my sound engineer and artistic co-creator, we probably wouldn't sound near as good. So he gives a lot of time and energy into making sure that we sound good and that the equipment is up and running. And so I very much appreciate Steve, as well as Blog Talk Radio, and all of you who come by and listen. Thank you so much. And so tonight's a little bit different for me because I'm not talking to you about music or history. We're going to talk about a little bit, but mostly tonight is about my professional side, which also is my holistic side. It encompasses everything, and that is that of being an educator. There's the green grape theory, which one of these days I'll actually share with you. Those of you who know me well know about the green grape. And the green grape is about exactly what Patrick's work and is all about. So today we're going to talk to Patrick Blessinger, coming to us from New York. And he is a profound educator and a mover and a shaker, a change agent, a transformer of education. And we're going to be talking with him today about meaning-centered education. Now, there's always different buzzwords in education, and, you know, we are struggling because not only do we need to obviously identify those changes that are necessary in the United States educational system, but how do we tackle the concept of a global understanding and making education accessible to every single person? So there are many different things we can talk about with that. But I want to start off with a quote by Kierkegaard. Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards. And it kind of goes along with a quote that I came up with one of my papers that I had to write years ago. Our desire for our future determines what our past would have been. And, you know, so what does that mean? And how do we begin to really embrace that? And so I want to really get into the biography or the background of Patrick and then bring him on the air. But first of all, he's a peer-recognized expert and thought leader in the field of higher education in teaching and learning. He's received several education awards, including the Fulbright Scholar from the United States Department of State and Governor's Teaching Fellowships from the state of Georgia. And he was selected as the honorary Rotarian for community service and volunteer activities. He's taught over 150 college and university courses. He's managed academic programs at colleges and universities in the United States and throughout Europe. He consults with higher education institutions in areas of technology, innovation, international collaboration, teaching and learning, and he serves as an academic and accreditation advisor for the higher education institutions. So I am very, very pleased to bring to you the founder and executive director of the International Higher Educational Teaching and Learning Association. And so without further delay, I'm going to bring Patrick on the air right now. Hi, Patrick. Welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly. Thank you for having me, Mary.
You're very welcome. This is an honor. I stumbled upon you through LinkedIn a few months ago, and I was very impressed with your work and very intrigued by it and interested in what you were doing and where you're going with blending this global understanding of education with the higher education and specifically through meaning-centered education. So I'm just going to give you the floor and let you get started in kind of giving an overview and, you know, let's get to know each other a little bit, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, again, thanks for having me, and I appreciate the kind introductory words. We met through LinkedIn, and probably most of your listeners know, and, you know, for those who may not know, LinkedIn is a social networking site, a professional social networking site. So it's a little bit different from social networking sites. And about... I guess about 3.5 years ago now, the ironic thing about myself and using social media is, although I've become rather successful in using it to achieve some of the goals that that I set for myself, and you know, and as an educator in the higher education space, I was actually a laggard. In using social media. I really didn't start using it until about 2009, 2010. But I saw I saw the tremendous potential in it, and so decided to sort of go a different route in my academic and educational career, and had this idea back in January of 2010 to use these modern technologies and social networking in particular as a vehicle and a mechanism to bring educators together from all over the world. And the nice thing about these types of modern social networking technologies is that really for the first time in human history, we have the potential to bring people together from regardless of where they live around the planet using technology. And so we've attempted to make, full use of those technologies. And so the group that I started in January 2010 called the Higher Education Teaching and Learning Association is a group of mainly higher education academics, professors and instructors, but also administrators and anyone involved in higher education. But it also includes people from the secondary school level also. So teachers, you know, are invited to join our group as well. And for your listeners, if you're in the educational space and consider yourself an educator and you haven't heard of our group before, I extend to you an invitation to join our group on LinkedIn. You can simply do a search on groups for higher education as the keywords, and it will come up. But I had I've been in education formally since the year 2000. And I started as an adjunct professor at a local community college in Atlanta. And I started as an adjunct or as a part-time instructor because I always had in the back of my mind this idea of maybe, you know, becoming an educator, becoming an instructor. I was intrigued with the idea because when I was going through my own university education at both the undergraduate and the graduate levels, I learned a lot, but there were I was convinced in going through it myself and with my own personal experiences as a student that there were areas that could really use improving and enhancing. And so even when I was a student, I had in the back of my mind, well, you know, one day maybe if I become an educator myself or a professor myself, maybe I'll have the opportunity to try to implement, you know, some of these things that I'm thinking about, some of these ideas, and make the educational process and the learning process more enjoyable, more interesting, more meaningful for all those involved, not just students, but for instructors and administrators as well. And so in the year 2000, I had an opportunity to teach part-time at a community college, and I did that. And my area was business and economics and information systems. And at the same time, I was working in the corporate world, working for a large telecommunications company, and enjoyed, you know, doing both as well. But in 2004, decided to go into education full time, and that's what I did. And found a full time instructorship at a college in Atlanta. And as it turned out, a couple of years after doing that in 2007, the stars sort of aligned for me in just the right way, and I was very fortunate to be awarded a Fulbright scholarship to teach in Denmark. And so that took me over to Denmark to teach and also to interact with educators from another country and to understand, you know, their pedagogical practices, their culture, their learning environments, and for them and for me to share my experiences with them also. So a very interactive experience, not just teaching per se, but also to embed myself within the culture. And so it was also very much a multicultural experience. And that really opened my eyes to a lot of things going on in higher education because, you know, I could see it from another perspective, from another cultural view as well. And so while I was over there, the stars also aligned for me again, and I met my wife while I was over there, and then we eventually got married. But after a 3-month assignment in Denmark, that brought me back to Atlanta to finish up my teaching contract at the college there in Atlanta. And I enjoyed the experience so much that I thought, man, that would be great, you know, if I could go back there and spend a lot more time back there, an extended stay, and teach full time. And as luck would have it, yeah. And plus, I had since I had met my my future wife there, I also had another very powerful incentive to want to go back. but as luck would have it, the stars aligned for me again, and I was offered a position at a college there in Copenhagen, and so that took me back there for another 3 years, and so I taught at that college for a couple of years as a full-time economics and business instructor and management instructor. They actually had me. It was a little bit different than how they normally do things in the U.S. Normally in the U.S., at least at the college and university level, if you're in a particular area, you are much more specialized. So the U.S. takes a much more specialized approach to teaching, and you're in a very narrow area of specialty. But in the college I was at, it was much more broader, and they allowed me to teach a variety of different courses under the business domain. And so I was teaching accounting and economics and management and marketing, and also working with my colleagues in the UK at the De Montfort University, because the program that I was in was a joint program between Niels Brock Copenhagen Business College in Copenhagen and the De Montfort University in the UK. And it was a special international honors program for international students, had about 100 students. And so they brought students from all over the world to attend that particular program. And so I really got immersed in a very multicultural, multilingual, and multinational program. And that I learned a lot from that and did that for a couple of years. And so at that point, I guess I had been teaching for over a decade. And I decided that I wanted to do something new and different and innovative, because I'd been teaching for quite a while at that point and had been co-managing that international program in Copenhagen at the same time. But I wanted to make, I had, I don't know, just sort of a fire in the belly, a burning desire to want to make change, make positive change in the educational space and higher education in particular. I can't really tell you where it came from or where it comes from, but it's just a burning desire to want to bring people together, to collaborate, to put our collective minds and talents together and come up with ways that that are beneficial to everyone, you know, in the educational process, both teachers, students, and administrators. And so I decided to leave my full-time teaching position there and start a new entrepreneurial effort, which ended up being the HEDL, Higher Education Teaching and Learning Association. So I just totally immersed myself in learning everything I could about higher education, about learning, building upon what I already knew, about innovation, academic innovation in particular, and entrepreneurship in the educational space, because those two concepts don't usually go, don't usually coincide. Traditionally, the idea of innovation and entrepreneurship and higher education, you usually didn't use those ideas or those words in the same sentence. But now we've gotten to the point in 2013 that it is acceptable to use those terms in the same sentence, to find the points of convergence and integration between innovation and academics. And how do we do that? Because traditionally, like I said, you know, they've been worlds apart. But we've made great strides in, you know, in the last few years in doing that. And that is one of the aims of HEDL, the Higher Education Teaching and Learning Association, is to explore these areas, bring educators together, and let's think outside the box. Let's think in new and innovative ways. With the ultimate goal still being the same, however, and that is, how do we improve educational outcomes? How do we improve learning outcomes? And how do we do that in such a way that it is enjoyable and interesting and personally meaningful for everyone engaged in the educational process? So I think we've made some good strides. We have just in our LinkedIn group alone, which is only been in existence for about 3.5 years, we have almost 28,000 members in our group, all educators, in one way or another, you know, that have some connection or relation to education. And so we come together and we dialogue and we discuss and we converse, and then we also do research and we produce publications. And one of them, of course, is the focus of this interview, and that is the whole idea of meaning-centered education and meaning-centered learning.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you about your collection is where did you or how did you encounter all of the individual contributors to your book? Did you actually collaborate, you know, collectively over a period of time? Are these people that you encountered one by one? Did they submit, you know, theses to you? I mean, how did you go about? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there was all of a sudden a really strange noise. Every once in a while, Skype does that, unfortunately. So,
yeah.
So how did you bring this particular work together before we kind of dig into it?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, every book project is different, and even if it's the same type of book, like an edited collection book, where some of the chapters are written by individual authors. Even those are different depending on, you know, the publisher that you're working with and the nature of the book and, you know, several other factors. But for this particular one, yeah, it was an edited book. And so we had about 10 different authors from across the world. I think they were from 4 or 5 different continents. And the idea for the book first came about when our first president, so I'm the executive director of the association, HEDL, which basically means I'm the chief executive officer and the founder for the association. But in forming the association, which is, you know, probably typical of, you know, most, if not all, nonprofit associations and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, you get to a point where if you want it to grow and you want it to become a little more formalized in what it does and a little more structured in what it does, you turn it into a legal entity, in this case a nonprofit association. And in doing that, you have to put together a board of directors. And on that board of directors, which is the governing board for the association, so the governing board, we have 12 people that serve 3-year terms. I'm also on the board as a standing co-chair of the board. But in addition to me, we, as the executive director, we also have a president who also serves as the other co-chair. And that person, the intent behind that position is that person represents the voice of the higher education space, and typically is a full-time, you know, professor or scholar or faculty member or maybe even administrator. But anyhow, so the when we first formed the board and turned HEDL into a nonprofit association, one of my first tasks as the founder and the CEO of the organization was to appoint all the initial board members and to appoint the first president. And the first president is a lady from Russia, an educator, Olga Kovbasyuk. And I met Olga, like I meet most people, through our LinkedIn group and through other avenues as well, but mainly through the LinkedIn group. And this was after we had created the our website for the HEDL Association, which is a portal. And on that portal, we have open educational and open journal, open access journal, which means it's like any other academic journal, except it's open, for people to access and read, so they don't have to pay a subscription or any kind of fee in order to access the journal. And she wrote one of the this was after she was I appointed her as our first president, and she wrote an article for the journal, which we published. And it's a peer-reviewed, double-blind review process. So we have a whole very rigorous process that all the submitted articles have to go through before they're published. But anyhow, she submitted an article, which we published, which was on this topic of meaning, meaningful education and meaning-centered education. And I was really captivated by that idea. And so I thought about it, and the idea for it kept percolating in my mind. And I got to a point where, just trusting my intuition and my instincts, I said, you know, this is really important. You know, I need to do some further research here and see if, you know, what has been written on this topic, because I think this is an absolutely critical and crucial topic for higher education today and for learning today. And the more I delved into it, and the more I found out about, you know, this whole area, which is vast, because just the topic of meaning itself is, you know, encompasses almost every, you know, aspect of life, and not just education, not just learning, but especially, you know, learning. I was convinced that, you know, this was an idea that needed to be explored in more depth, and was an idea that I needed to collaborate with Olga on to further develop. And so I contacted Olga, and I said, hey, are you interested in possibly writing a book on this topic? And she said, you know, she thought it was a wonderful idea. And so that's how the collaboration started. We first met on LinkedIn, and then she became president of the association. And then she wrote an article that touched upon the topic. And then I contacted her to see if she wanted to collaborate on expanding on that and expounding on that whole topic area. And we did, and so we put together a proposal, and this is sort of typical in the publishing world and publishing process. So for your listeners who might be interested in publishing a book someday, you might want to take a few notes. But it usually starts with an idea, a good idea, that, and then you have to convince the publisher that it's not only a good idea, it's a great idea, and that it addresses something that no one else has really addressed in quite the way that you're doing it, you know. And so we put together, you know, a multi-page proposal, and we decided that we wanted it to be an edited book because we thought, well, it will we can get. It will be more beneficial to people, and maybe they'll have a clearer sense of what the topic is all about if we bring in more perspectives, you know, on the topic, and not just the perspective of Olga and myself. And so that's what we did. We actually approached it. I mean, and now I'm kind of more getting to, you know, directly answering your question that you asked a few minutes ago, but we actually used a variety of means to find our chapter authors. One, we started with people we already knew who were you know, educators and scholars who we thought might be able to write on a particular aspect of meaning-centered education. So Olga sort of took that piece of it. For my piece, what I did was I actually put out a call. So I'm a member of a lot of different listservs and different social networking groups. And on one of the listservs, I simply put out a call a message to everyone on that listserv, which is, I think, about maybe about 1,000 people. And they're all educators, mainly professors and faculty developers. And I asked them if anyone had, you know, could share their thoughts or, you know, resources or information on this topic of meaning-centered education. And what I was surprised to find out that no one really knew what I was talking about. They didn't really have a good understanding of what this whole topic, you know, was about. And most of them, if not all of them, had never heard of that particular phrase before, meaning-centered education or meaning-centered learning. But once we started to have a dialogue about it on the listserv, and I began to describe, you know, my thoughts on, you know, meaning-centered education and what it was about, and shared some resources with them, then I identified three or four people, you know, from that particular listserv who expressed an interest in contributing to the book. And so that's how we came up with the contributors. You know, one, you know, from a few people from who we knew, you know, from our personal network. And two, just, you know, I put out a call to a particular listserv and engaged in a dialogue and a conversation over a period of a couple of weeks with people on that listserv. And from that emerged, three or four people who were both qualified to, you know, to talk on the topic, and also who could give a perspective on the topic of meaning-centered education that would allow us to craft an outline for the book where we discuss the book from and discuss the idea of meaning-centered education from several different points of view. I guess the third way was there was a couple of people on the listserv who said, well, no, I'm not interested, you know, that's really sort of outside my area of expertise, but you should talk to so-and-so, you know, mm-hmm. at, you know, a university in the UK, and they would give me his or her email address. And I would simply, you know, send an inquiry, you know, to that person and explain what we were doing and explain a little bit about the book and see if they were interested. And that's how we got, you know, two or three more people. So multiple methods, but it all starts with having a dialogue and talking with people and getting the getting the word out there to the right people about the project that we're working on. And then slowly over the course of maybe a month or two, probably 6 or 7 weeks, we had identified about 10 people who were willing to contribute chapters to the book. But the whole project itself, from beginning to end, probably lasted about 2 years. So once we came up with once Olga and I agreed that it would make a good topic for a book, to the mm-hmm. point where the book actually came out was almost a 2-year process.
Yeah,
which is not that untypical for say an academic or an educational type book.
Exactly. The research that goes into it is pretty in-depth. And one of the things that, well, I was immediately drawn to the title because I have, for as long as I can remember, you know, and I touched on it when I was giving the intro about the green grape theory to learning. And, you know, that's, that will be something that I can imagine expounding on at some point in time in my life. And, you know, and it is a driving force. So I'm going to leave everybody kind of hanging. I'll let you know what the green grape theory is in some point in time in my life. But through that, I've discovered in being my, first I was my children's first teacher, and I took that very seriously. Became very involved in their lives academically, and at some point in time decided, you know, kind of like yourself, there was this burning desire, I needed to do more, I needed to go further with this, and I needed to be an innovator and a transformer, because I witnessed in my own experience and in my children's that there's something that's very, very lacking. And for myself, I express meaning-centered education through the concept of play-based learning and holistic approach. And I realize that there are some shared components and there are some very different components. And one of the things that I have discovered is the most difficult aspect as an educator in being one who wants to transform and be a change agent in education is that our system in the United States, for example, is so lock solid. No matter what changes we imagine that we are making, we are really not willing to let go. And the resistance to change, the autonomy that is so prevalent in our educational systems. You touched on it by discussing the very focused way in which educators, especially today, are assigned to their duties. Oh, you have to have this exact endorsement, and if you don't have these exact endorsements, there's no way possible that you could teach, you know, outside of that particular endorsement. And so people are we've become even more compartmentalized. The more standards that are imposed, the more skill-focused and direct we are. And so I'm watching all of this going on around me, and I've discovered that as soon as you start using certain words, transformation, holistic, you know, meaning, creating meaning, it's like right away it's like, oh, well, that's called differentiated instruction. No. This goes much deeper than that. This is about, you know, I looked at your PowerPoint at the 2012 I can't say the word.
Yeah. Felicitology.
Thank you so much. I tried to say it all day today, and I'm like, you're going to stumble on that one for sure. Anyway, we have our moments, right? So, you know, and I know when I first reached out to you, I said, I think we need to, after reading, you know, getting into the book, is that we need to think of a book titled Resistance to Change at the Heart of Public Education.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, that's my experience. And now I'm seeing these changes. You know, today the NEA came out and they began to denounce online educational processes. There's another, now there's this movement to make all higher education free for everybody. And, you know, so I continue to see, you know, we see the buildup of the alternative track educational programs where they teach kids only to teach in this particular way, in this particular process, and exactly in this formulated process. So how do you tackle being someone who is global in thought and in process? How do we begin to break down that wall of resistance? Is it going to take a battering ram, or do we have the luxury of time to continue to keep on, you know, processing through this? What are your feelings on all of that?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm in favor of the battering ram approach.
That was No Child Left Behind.
I think, you know, it's just human nature, you know. I mean, so much of what we deal with is human nature, you know. And one aspect of of human nature, I suppose, is a fear about, you know, dealing with uncertainty. And because with uncertainty comes sort of a fear of the unknown, you know, will this really produce the, you know, the results that, you know, people are claiming it will have. There's uncertainty, you know, around any new or innovative idea or program, you know, that is put out there. And so that's natural and you know, should probably, we shouldn't be too surprised, you know, if especially the more, you know, the more innovative an idea is, you know, typically, and maybe even the more radical or transformative the idea is, even if once you peel back a few layers of the onion, it turns out to be a rather simple or straightforward notion, you know, about, you know, what you're proposing, there's still, you know, uncertainty around anything that's new. And so people naturally have a built-in resistance to that because of the fear of the unknown. That's one. And then two, you know, people also have vested interest there's a certain amount of vested interest that comes along with maintaining, you know, the status quo, whatever the status quo is. And that's natural also, you know. So that's, you know, some of that can be expected also because, you know, if we implement, you know, this new program, you know, or new idea, you know, how is this going to affect, you know, my position, you know. So some of that can be expected. So I don't think it would serve any useful purpose. And I know, you know, it can be for people who are innovators and, you know, who feel very, maybe very strongly about a particular idea, you know, or how something, a program or a system, you know, should change. I just don't think it, you know, I have, the more we try to maybe, you know, force that idea, I think the more resistance we're going to encounter. And so that's why, you know, I'm just not in favor of him being too forceful, you know, to bring about change. I think the best we can do, you know, this is, you know, my view and my opinion in working with a lot of educators, you know, from all of the world and all different types of systems and cultures and capacities and going through the really oftentimes difficult process of forming an organization, you know, taking something just from an idea and creating it into a full-fledged, you know, sort of global organization and network, you know, what people don't see, you know, is, you know, all that sometimes the heartache and the trials, you know, that you have to go through and the difficulties sometimes you have to go through in bringing all of that about, you know, because it doesn't just magically happen, you know. There's a lot of, you know, dialogue that takes place there. Sometimes there are concessions, you know, that take place, especially if, you know, like me, I was adamant from day one that the group, HETL, Higher Education Teaching Learning Association, for example, needed to be based on, you know, some core values. So in addition to our vision and our mission, we also needed to have, you know, core values that defined what the organization was about, that defined the personality and the identity of the organization. And and so in thinking through all that and getting a lot of feedback from a lot of different people and a huge diversity of opinions and thoughts and ideas, we came up with, you know, three very simple and straightforward core values that we felt were universal academic core values that defined who we were and that everyone could agree with and rally around, and those being diversity, collegiality, and academic integrity. And in each one, you know, you could have a whole, you know, hour-long, you know, sort of interview on just each one. But diversity is, feel very strongly about that we need to, that the group, if we are going to be one of the voices for education, you know, in the world, that our organization needs to be truly representative of everyone, you know, in the world and in education in particular. But diversity can be, you know, there are many different forms and characteristics of diversity. I mean, in the U.S., we typically think of diversity in terms of gender and race and ethnicity. And, you know, we should. Those are absolutely critical. But there are also many other forms of diversity, you know, diversity of opinions, diversity of ideas, diversity of, so diversity of learning, you know, which is one of and diversity of teaching, you know, methods. And those, in fact, is one of the core principles of that we talk about in the book, Meaning-Centered Education. So after all of our analysis, we were able to define diversity, learning diversity and pedagogical pluralism as one of the core principles of meaning-centered education. And so diversity is very important to us. That's why even when we crafted the organization's constitution and bylaws, we put a clause in there that said we appoint a new president every year. And so, in the Constitution, we specified that the president must be from a different country, a different nationality each year. So in our first president was Olga Kovbasyuk, and she was from Russia. Our second president was Charles Weinkel, from St. John's University, and he's from the U.S., Boston in particular. And our third president, who we just installed a week ago, is John Anchin, and he's from Canada. And our vice president, who by our bylaws automatically becomes the president at the end of the year, which would be June 30th of next year. She's from Poland. And so, you know, we take very seriously the idea of diversity in all its forms because, one, fundamentally, it's just the right thing to do, you know, if we purport to be an organization that represents and tries to be a voice for education, that we need to be representative of all the different aspects of the educational community.
One of the things that you touched on, which I think is huge, and it's one of the things that is we are moving further and further away from in our, with unfortunately in the United States, with the imposition of standards, and now, you know, with core standards, the list goes on and on of the things that our classroom teachers are up against. And I know it is spilling into very profoundly into the higher educational community. My daughter is a professor, and she is, you know, shared some of the things that they're looking at. And that is that we have for years discussed the concept that our children learn differently. We still continue to wage the battle that, you know, not every child is going to learn the same in the same way, and that, you know, they're as individual as their home life. And one of the things that I have been a huge proponent of is that we as educators also, not only do we learn differently, we teach differently, and it's impossible to say one is better than the other. But when we But we are moving more and more into this unfortunate frustration that says all teachers look exactly like this, walk exactly like this, talk exactly like this, and this is how you will teach. And if you don't, you're not going to pass the grade and you're going to be gone next year. And so unfortunately, yeah. Teachers have become, you know, they're terrified. And I think that one of the things that I'm very glad that you brought that up, and that, you know, you are, I've always said, it trickles from the top down. Our higher education, you know, beginning with the end in mind. And I've said this, you know, to borrow from Covey, I've said this over and over again. Our, you know, college professors need to remember what it is to be a kindergartner, and see from that point on how they process to get to that classroom. And if there's a disconnect in that, then we run into, we continue to have this abyss grow greater and greater in our educational systems. And I appreciate the fact that you have gone out, and I love the concept of the entrepreneurial educator. I think that that's an imperative. That is where we begin to see that diversity in pedagogy come into each individual classroom and into our schools, and begin to facilitate true differentiated instruction in its totality. So that brings up the concept then, or the definition. What is meaning-centered education, meaning-centered learning?
Well, it is, I suppose, in one respect, it is maybe a complex topic and a difficult topic, because the whole idea of meaning and what is meaning, touches upon every aspect of our lives, you know, as humans, you know, personally, socially, cognitively, emotionally, you know. And, but I guess the best way to describe it, and, cause we put this, you know, somewhere in the book there, we had to define it in a way that we, distilled, you know, all of this research, you know, down to, you know, its bare essence, in the form of a question. And the question we came up with was, how do we make the meaning-making process, which is what education and learning is all about, you know, it's all about making meaning, regardless of what subject, you know, we're learning, whether it's math or physics or art or humanities or history or whatever, you know. It's all a meaning-making process, but how do we make the meaning-making process more personally meaningful? So there are several different aspects, you know, to that question, and several different implications of that question, because the meaning-making process we typically think of just purely a cognitive process where we're learning certain knowledge and facts, and that's one aspect of it. But it doesn't necessarily have to be exclusively that. And that's where the second part of the question comes in. How do we make that, basically make the learning process and the educational process more personally meaningful, so that me as a learner, as a student, but also me as an instructor, if I'm an instructor or an educator or a parent, you know, because parents are also, you know, involved in education, you know, maybe not formal education, but definitely informal education, and in teaching, you know, their children and bringing up their children. And so, unfortunately, I think education in the past, and a lot of people talk about this now, like Sir Ken Robinson. There's very good YouTube videos speeches by Sir Ken Robinson, who talks about the factory model or the production model, or the industrial model of education, especially K through 12, and how it evolved, you know, has evolved over the last, I guess, 150 years or so since we've, you know, have taken on this notion of universal education. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we implemented very much a factory model of education. And some would argue that, you know, we're still doing that. Even,
right.
You know, even within all the reforms that have attempted to be put out there, you know, in the educational space, that especially K through 12 education is, you know, perhaps still has, you know, vestiges of that factory model approach to educating students, where the whole idea is on knowledge acquisition and learning facts, and really operating at that lower level of Bloom's taxonomy. So Benjamin Bloom, you know, which is his taxonomy, is considered sort of one of the hallmarks of education and learning, and he defined, I think seven different levels of learning and thinking skills. And he put them in order from top to bottom. And at the lowest level is knowledge acquisition. So we talk so much about knowledge acquisition as the hallmark of learning. But what Bloom, his major contribution to education and learning, is that he showed that knowledge acquisition is actually the lowest, at the lowest level of learning. It's certainly a prerequisite, you know, to higher levels of learning, but it's still nonetheless, you know, a lower form of learning. And unfortunately, I think all too often, as teachers and as policymakers and administrators, and maybe even, you know, some students also, they get stuck in the lower level. They get overly focused on just the knowledge level, and where we should be focusing our time and attention and focus on the higher levels of learning, such as judgment and synthesis, and how do I connect all the dots? How do I look at the big picture? What are the big questions, you know, in life? And how do I look at a problem or a question from multiple points of view that cross disciplines and involve connecting the dots across different disciplines. And I think that's where, you know, we need to be focused on. The contribution of the meaning-centered education idea and book is, okay, yes, all that's true, but how do we make all of that personally meaningful for students and everyone else involved in the educational process, so that learning, so that we create happy, you know, we talked about felicitology, which is just a fancy word for happiness, you know, basically, but how do we create happy learners? How do we create happy teachers? How do we create happy administrators? Well, there are, you know, several different components and aspects of that. But,
well, Patrick, I have to, unfortunately, I've gotten the warning that we've only got 60 seconds left of the show.
Oh, my.
This has just gone by like a snap. But I want so much, and I will post the information on how people can find you and find the book, find out more. And I would love to have you come back again, since we've gotten to, and we need to do a part two.
Yeah, because I feel like we've just scratched the surface of it.
I know. Yeah. So we need a part two of this. So please come back again very soon. And all of our listeners, we will have a part two, and we will actually talk about meaning-centered education. There is way too much here to just let it go by. So thank you so much
for
joining us, and we will talk again real soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we've been talking with Patrick Blessinger, and he is the one of the editors of the book Meaning-Centered Education with HETL, HETL.org. We will continue this conversation again sometime very soon. Thank you so much for joining us. And as always, thanks for coming to the diner. Bye.